Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation site. This is John Suntress. From his groundbreaking work on Orion, Thor, Star Wars, and Dr. Fate, to Elric, the Fantastic Four, Batman, and beyond, artist Walt Simonson continues to influence current creators and aspiring hopefuls. That next generation of artists can learn directly from Walt at New York's legendary School of Visual Arts. Our conversation begins with Walt's description of how he came to work on the new 1973 version of DC's Manhunter.
Archie Goodwin asked me to do it. Archie was the editor of Detective Comics at the time. He was one of the first editors I worked for. I think he was the second editor I actually had any jobs for when I first came to New York in 1972. Archie was the editor of Detective Comics. I had become that. At the time, it was a Batman lead story and a short backup story. Archie, I think, decided that he wanted to do a backup story, maybe go in a new direction rather than use an established DC sort of secondary character. His idea was to do a strip that would complement Batman, which is where Batman was pretty much all the city. It was all Gotham. It was, you know, kind of unarmed combat in a sense. It was detective work. He had an idea for a strip that would be more outgoing. The world would be the stage. You know, weaponry developed as we went along, combat in various forms, and kind of a broader mission. It wasn't simply a crime-fighting story. Not that Batman's ever very simple, but it was just a sort of a larger stage for the character to work on. That also led to the fact that his costume was red, for example, red and white, mm-hmm. and a little bit of blue, which was in contrast to Batman's gray and black, and, you know, blacks, shadows, and blue. So Archie's idea was to invent this, you know, put this character in the back of Detective Comics. The name Manhunter was trademarked by DC. They had the trademark already. Mm-hmm. And it's also, you know, when you have a trademark, you have to use it from time to time to ensure that you keep the trademark. You're not accused of abandoning it. So the name was available. I guess at the time, there weren't any characters that DC was publishing under that name.
Was the Kirby Manhunter, I remember that first issue special that Jack did, was that before your guys...
No, that was after.
Okay.
The first issue specials were, they were 74, 75, somewhere in there. The Manhunter strip ran from 73 to 74, and it preceded the second Jack Kirby Manhunter. Of course, there was the character that Kirby and I think Simon mm-hmm. did in the 40s that was Manhunter. And we eventually did some springboarding off of some of that material, although that wasn't the original idea. It wasn't what we didn't plan it at the beginning, or Archie hadn't planned to do it. But anyway, he came up with the idea for character. I had done a bunch of work for him by the time he was looking around for an artist, and I think I'd done some stuff that he liked. Well, I must have, because he kept hiring me to do backup stories. And when this came along, he talked to me about becoming the artist for it. I thought that would be kind of neat. I liked Archie a lot. I worked with him very well. I thought he was a remarkably good editor, and as well as a remarkably good writer and a remarkably good cartoonist. He was everything. He really was an all-inclusive package. So we began working on it together. In the beginning, I was working from, I think, Archie's full script, and by the end, we were working more Marvel style, where I was working from his plot, and then he would write dialogue off the artwork.
Were you able to get any type of fan response while the strip was running? I know it was bi-monthly, and it was relatively short.
Detective Comics changed format right after the strip began. So the very first issue, 437, I think, that the strip was in, there was a lead Batman story and a backup 8-page Manhunter story, and that was it. With the second issue in which Manhunter appeared, the comic went to 100 pages, mm-hmm. where they ran, I've forgotten how long the lead story was. It must have been about 12 pages, I suppose, maybe 14, and an 8-page backup. And then the rest of the material was reprint material. Mm-hmm. But the Manhunter strip remained... It was 8 pages. It ran for a year, a little over a year. It was a bi-monthly book, so the strip ran every 2 months. The first 5 chapters were 8 pages each. As we were approaching the climax, the 6th chapter, I think, was 9 pages. And because it had been in the Batman book in Detective, Archie and I had the idea that somewhere along the way we thought it would be fun to put Manhunter and Batman together. Now, Archie was leaving DC Comics at the time. He had gotten a job offer from Warren Publishing, decided to go over there. He'd been there once already, mm-hmm. and he was going back there as an editor. So we knew, I guess, from about the 5th chapter on that he was going to be leaving. Julie Schwartz was taking over the book. Julie was going to, I forgot who he was going to put in the back of the comic. It was not going to be Manhunter. Might have been the Elongated Man or somebody else. I don't remember now. But for me, the character of Manhunter was really, that was me and Archie working together. And I had no, I mean, even if Julia had an interest, and Julia didn't have any interest, but if he had, I really wouldn't have wanted to work on the character of anybody else. So we knew the strip was wrapping up. We knew we were going to end it from the fifth chapter on. And we tailored the story to completion. And the result was that the final chapter was, we also, it must have been 12-page Batman story, because the final chapter was a 20-page story that was essentially a Batman-Manhunter crossover.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and we wrapped everything up in that last chapter.
Yeah.
But as far as, you know, as far as fan response, I remember virtually none. This is 73, 74. There wasn't any direct market at the time. There were very few comic shops, if there were any. I don't remember the first time I was in a comic shop, but I'm not sure I was in one before 74. Super Snipe was in New York, and that was somewhere at that time. Might have been a little bit later, might have been a little bit earlier. I don't remember any longer. But, there, you know, you got letters, and there. I'm sure I read some letters. I'm sure letters came in. None of them stick in my memory at this point, because people were still, there were still letter columns, and people were still sending stuff in by snail mail.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
So there would have been some comments like that, but I, you know, to tell you the truth, I don't recall them. As they say, at this point in time, it's too long ago. So, oh, hang on, what was that, Sherry? Oh, well, the strip got some professional accolades.
Oh, that's good. At the time.
It did, at the time, yes. There was about maybe a five-year period where there was an organization called the Academy of Comic Book Arts, ACBA for short, and they awarded what was called the Shazam Award.
Oh, yeah.
So it was essentially, it was an Academy Award for comics.
Mm-hmm.
The organization eventually broke apart, which was too bad, but it was around at the time Manhunter was coming out. And so over the strip ran over ran for a year, but between 73 and 74. And so for those 2 years, between Archie and myself and the strip, we won six Shazam Awards.
Wow.
And we won, in 73 we had best short story, in 74 we had best short story and best long story for the Batman crossover.
Okay.
Archie won best writer both in 73 and 74, I think largely in the strength of the Manhunter work. And in 73 I won best rookie of the year, or whatever, the best new talent, I think. I tied with Jim Starlin. Jim Starlin and I shared the award for best new talent in 73.
That's cool.
And that was really because of Manhunter. I mean, that was the strip that made my, you know, established me professionally.
No question.
Before that, I mean, I've been doing comics maybe about 6 months, and Archie offered me the strip. And when I began doing the strip, you know, I mean, I knew a lot of the young guys, but I would not have been well-known in the industry. And by the time that strip was over, a lot of editors whom I wouldn't have met at that point at least knew who I was.
That's cool.
And I was really able to, you know, I had work thereafter.
Yeah, and one thing that I remember right after that, then, your first issue special of Dr. Fate.
That's right. That was shortly after Manhunter, I think.
What a great book. And it just a one-shot, and it's such a shame that you were never given an ongoing Fate, because what you did with the Ankhs and just the look of Dr. Fate and the Tower, you really cemented the character for really the interpretation that it had through Kent Nelson being Dr. Fate.
It did. I mean, it was kind of funny. It was really just a one-shot. Marty Pascoe wrote it. He was writing at the time a great deal. We were buds, and he worked on it. I worked on it with him. One of the funny things about that strip, I couldn't give you the original plot. What if Marty has a copy somewhere? I have to ask Marty if he has a copy somewhere. Because what happened was, we were in the middle of that story, and now, again, I can't give you the page count for sure. Let's say it was a 20-page comic.
Sure.
It might have been 22, whatever it was. And in the middle of the story, DC cut 2 pages from their book. So I was in the middle of drawing it when we were told, oh, by the way, instead of being 20 pages, it'll be 18. Or instead of 22, it'll be 20, whatever the final number was.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to go back and do a pretty fast dance in the middle of the story in order to get it shortened up enough to have it come out where it did. That's the one thing I remember about that, and I don't remember what the original version was. Kent's wife, Inza, I think she finds a small hieroglyphic fragment that has the name of the mummy, Calcric, which is what Fate uses to defeat him, partly because in magic, names are always important. And she pretty much finds it kind of out of the blue, and that was part of what we had to do in order to make the story, in order to shorten up 2 pages. I don't remember how it worked out before that, but it was a lot of fun. It was my youthful hubris. I was a big Doctor Strange fan from the Steve Ditko days,
mm-hmm.
and one of the things I loved about Ditko's work in the Doctor Strange, I loved his work in general, but in the Doctor Strange material, I thought that Steve really invented, over the course of that strip and his work on it, a graphic system of magic where It was neat looking. It was very bold. It was very graphic. And it was completely clear as to what was happening. You know, even if you didn't read, you know, by the seven moons of Ragador, or the shades of the seraphim, or whatever was, you know, Stan was writing, mm-hmm. you always knew, you know, magic shields were up. It was a series of vectors. The vectors would smash through stuff. So it was completely clear just from the drawing how the magic worked. I thought that was really, it was a remarkable achievement, really, graphically and graphic storytelling on a strip about magic where you really, you know, it's magic. You really just, you've got the world to play with. You can kind of do anything, and, you know, it can be awful or good, or but there's no rules.
Yes.
There are no rules. And so Steve did a beautiful job of formulating, you know, a very sensible graphic system. So when I did Dr. Fate, one of my youthful ambitions was to kind of create not a counter system, but a different system of graphic magic that would work as well. I didn't really succeed, but, you know, but it was really, part of it was my art school background in that I had taken topography and some lettering, which I really enjoyed. I liked letter forms a great deal, both calligraphic letter forms and more formal typefaces.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought the Ankh was a symbol of life from Egypt would be a really cool symbol to apply to Dr. Fate, and then to try and turn that into a sort of a unit of graphic magic and be able to, you know, repeat it in various forms to make magic actually happen. I mean, it still owed a great deal to what Ditko had done, but it gave me a different place to start. And that was one of the things that I was working very hard to do on that strip when I was doing it. But I really, I mean, I love doing it. There are people, you know, to this day, I meet fans who really enjoyed that one. It was a one issue.
Yeah.
Mario and I had a great time working together, and it was cool. It was really... You know, I am kind of sorry I haven't gone back to the character since, although the character has come so far now just as an entity in the DC universe that I wouldn't recognize him now. But it was fun then. I think it did kind of give the character a boost into a more prominent place just in DC storytelling. Marty and I both, I think Marty liked mythological type stuff as well. I know when we did a couple of issues of the Metal Men together.
Okay.
About that same time, somewhere right in there, 76, 74, 75, 76, somewhere in there. And there was some, we did some Eclipso stuff that had kind of some, you know, mythological stuff that we invented, but it had roots in actual mythology. So I think, I don't know that I would, you know, claim much out of that, but it just seemed that the Egyptian background that was available was a one way of giving, maybe enlarging the character's background, making it a little richer, making the character himself richer. And that was really, that's kind of what we were trying to do.
Let's switch and go to Marvel for a second and talk about Thor.
Okay.
And your wonderful run on Thor, including, of course, the creation of Beta Ray Bill and the way that it really just knocked everybody out. I mean, what an amazing departure. And clearly your love of mythology runs through things like Thor and Orion as well, which we'll get to later. But I'm wondering, where did Beta Ray Bill come from?
I had an abiding interest in mythology before I got even into comics. Mm-hmm. I loved mythology as a kid. I particularly like Norse mythology. There's a lot less of it than there is, say, of Greek and Roman, and it's more fatalistic and it's kind of grimmer. And you know, when you're a kid, you can afford to be grim because dying's a long way off. So what the heck? But I really love that stuff. And I, you know, whether the fact that my grandparents came from Norway had anything to do with it, I had never felt like that. But I look back now, going, gee, I wonder if there's something going on there. I don't know. Anyway, when I discovered Marvel Comics, I found them when I was in college. That would have been about 1965. 66, and they were really what I consider really hitting their stride.
Yes.
You know, Jack was doing some of the best work of his career, so was Stan.
Mm-hmm.
Ditko was as well. A lot of other guys like Don Heck were doing really, really, you know, beautiful work. It was it was a lot of fun, and the energy that ran through the Marvel books, all 11 of them back in those days, was really a delight. I mean, Woody was doing, Wallace Wood was doing mm-hmm. some work. There were a lot of cool guys doing stuff, and I mean, artists ranging from, you know, titans in the field to guys that were craftsmen, if not as well known, but were doing some of the best work of their careers as well. And Roy Thomas had just come in, was doing writing there, so was Archie, so was Denny O'Neill. And those guys very shortly thereafter were part of the mix as well. So I follow all that stuff. In doing so, when I did so, rather, Thor remained my favorite of all the Marvel comics. I mean, I was a big Fantastic Four fan, a big Spider-Man fan, a big Iron Man fan, but Thor... probably because of the Norse antecedents, was something I was just delighted by when I discovered. It was the first Marvel comic I found. And the fact that Thor had blonde hair instead of having red hair, didn't have a beard and so on, you know, I didn't really care. I figured if I wanted to read the myth, I could go buy a book and read the myth.
Sure.
But I liked the idea of the stories that were being told, and I got in right at what I still consider to be kind of the best run of that book. I got in right after, well, issue 120, Journey to Mystery 120, which was the beginning of a four-part story involving Loki and the Absorbing Man, and Loki's, you know, one of his many attempts to overthrow Odin and take over Asgard. There hadn't been quite so many attempts back then. But there was about a two-year run there where Stan and Jack just told some great stories. They kind of threaded a bunch of stories together, and some of the subplots ran over issues. You have things, you know, you see, here's a picture of the little stones lying in the jungle. What can these mean? And then they're off, and then never referred to again that issue. And three or four issues, you have little stones in the jungle, and boom, then suddenly they become important. And they introduced Hercules. They crossed the mythologies for the first time, really, in that series of stories. They did they invented the Destroyer. It was right before that. The Trial of the Gods began 116. The Asgard Troll War, which is around 138, 139. There's a whole host of stories that I just enjoyed immensely. So when I had a shot at doing the book, Mark Gruenwald, who was the editor of the book at the time, asked me if I'd be interested in writing and drawing it. At that point, this is 83,
okay.
I'd written four or five issues of Battlestar Galactica. I'd written the graphic novel that I'd drawn of my own characters called the Star Slammers. I'd written the movie adaptation for the first Indiana Jones film.
Yes.
Three issues of that. And that was about it, really, as far as my writing chops were concerned. But Mark and I had talked about it, and he knew I was a big Thor fan, and we had talked about some ideas I'd had at one point. So he offered me the book as a writer-artist, and I'd drawn Thor for a year in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. Len Wein had written it. I'd done layouts. Tony DeZuniga had done the inks. And this was a chance to write it and draw it. So I jumped at the opportunity. And I had a great time with it. Well, one of my inspirations for that was, I mean, Jack Kirby, going back to Jack once again, his work over at DC on the New Gods and the Forever People, Mr. Miracle, Jimmy Olsen, the collective Fourth World.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't so much that I was trying to do his gods at all, but I was still reading comics when Jack began doing it. It was like 70, 71.
Mm-hmm.
I was still in school. I hadn't gotten into comics yet when those books began to come out. And I was a big Jack Kirby fan already. I couldn't wait for his DC material. The first issue to come out was an issue of Jimmy Olsen. I remember buying that issue and being completely blown out of the water by it.
Yeah.
It couldn't have been more different from the preceding issue of Jimmy Olsen than Night Is From Day. And I just loved it. I loved all that stuff. I'm a giant Fourth World fan. But I loved the split, the leap off the cliff from one issue to the next in Jimmy Olsen when Jack took it over. So when I began to do Thor, my thought was to try and kind of replicate that leap. It was nowhere near as big. It was just, you know, I'm not Jack Kirby. But the idea that somehow you could just start off and take a story in a new direction, take a character in a new direction, and really, you know, not quite leave the past behind, because, of course, we're all continuity fanatics, but set up stories that didn't depend on preceding issues, didn't depend on a real knowledge of stuff that had happened. I tried to work in, you know, all the information you needed to follow the stories was going to be in the issues I was doing. And I wanted to go in some direction that hadn't been done before. That was probably key. In Thor, so I thought about it a lot, and in Thor, one of the things that nobody had really done, except for a couple of minor oddball things, was nobody had picked up Thor's hammer.
Mm-hmm.
They'd made a big deal out of it. Of course, there's the inscription on the hammer that says, "Whosoever holds this hammer, if he be worthy, shall possess the power of Thor." And they made a big deal out of it. Of course, Donald Blake grabs it and turns into Thor.
Right.
And there is actually an earlier Jack Kirby, Stan Lee comic where Loki holds the hammer because he has some extra enchantment from the Norn Queen. I'm sorry. That's not going to work. I understand it was, even at the time I went, wait a minute. You know, I didn't believe. So I kind of discount that myself. I don't care how much enchantment the Norn Queen adds to Loki. It's just not going to happen. But actually, the scene, it was very funny. So I thought it might be kind of cool to have a character pick up the hammer. At the same time, you know, when you're writing stories, you'd like to misdirect the reader. I don't want to lie to the reader, but I'd like the reader to think that this is happening over here when really what's happening is over there. So when you finally reveal what's happening over there, it's a surprise and a delight, rather than, oh, yeah, I've seen this story a million times. This is going to happen next. So in the case of the hammer, What I wanted was a character. I decided to invent a new character rather than, I kind of wanted to start fresh. I didn't want to say, oh, look, really, Baldur could hold the hammer. Or, oh, look, really, Captain America could hold the hammer. Or, you know, put in your favorite character.
Right.
I figured the hammer had been around a long time. It's been around the Marvel Universe a long time. Nobody's picked it up. That probably means nobody really can pick it up. Now, I think no one ever thought about it either, but that was the idea. That was my kind of my back thinking. So I wanted to invent a new character, and I thought it would be interesting if the character were something really different from what you'd expect. So I went for an alien. I gave him a backstory that I thought would make him noble, that would make him self-sacrificing, that would make him the warrior of his people. At the same time, you know, I want to worry the readers, because that's really my job. My job, you know, you go to comic shops and people grouse about, I mean, they used to grouse like Chris Claremont's plots all the time in the X-Men. Oh, they're like a million plot threads. Oh, I'm so tired. Why did they ever reveal, you know, end those threads? Why do this? Why do they do that? And they're out there buying Chris's comics seriously.
Yep.
Well, I'm sorry. That's the actual vote. I don't care what you actually say about the comics. But if you're out there buying them, that's your vote. So Chris was a master at that stuff. So I thought, I didn't have any subplots myself, but I thought I wanted to keep the reader from discovering that Bill was really a good guy. It would get, at least in the beginning, it would give me some conflict, some interest, and also I could appall readers because a bad guy, or at least not a noble guy like Thor, was picking up the hammer. And that's the reason that Bill looked as he did. It's very funny because, you know, when I did this story originally, this story's been repeated several times, I designed the character. I designed his head around that of a horse's skull.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that was that two reasons, really, the symbolism of it. One is a horse, you know, skulls in general are emblematic of death. So that's the scary part of it. And that's what we think of. You see skulls mostly. It's like, you know, I mean, it could be Goth, too. But the idea is it has, you know, echoes of death somehow attached to it, of course. On the other hand, horses are just beautiful creatures. And so I thought, using kind of a horse's skull as the basis for the career, I mean, I did not go back and, like, you know, do musculature and line out a horse's skull exactly, but that's why it's got that weird-shaped mouth. And I thought, you know, I can kind of access both, like, the death idea and maybe a little of the beauty idea as well by doing something like that. Now, what's funny is I occasionally read disparaging remarks now, like, oh, that horse's skull, I don't know, blah, 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 you know. And I will say this, I read all the letters that came into Thor, because I used to write those letter columns for all the ones that I wrote. And if I wrote and drew it, and even the ones I wrote and didn't draw, I wrote the letter columns. So I read everything that came into Thor. Until I began to tell people where that design came from, nobody wrote me and said, oh, yeah, it was a horse's skull.
That's interesting.
Nobody had a clue. So when I see people, you know, condescending to it now, it's like, oh, shut up. You know, please. Get a life. Me and Bill Shatner. So... But that's what the idea for the visuals came from.
That's cool.
And the reason for that, the other reason for that, the storytelling reason for that, is that in comics at the time, this would not be as true now because now we have these long story arcs, you have a lot of reprints, you have trade paperbacks. It's a different, kind of a different market in a way that still, I think we're still kind of developing it. We're still feeling our way along about it. But back then, comics were a monthly basis, and once they were out, you very rarely saw them again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, of course, we all kept our old comics. But it wasn't like you got them in new forms or they came back in reprints. So the thing about a 22-page story, which is what Marvel Comics were at the time, you don't have a lot of room. You have to make your point fast, and you make your point through a combination of the writing and the drawing. And one of the ways that you use the drawing is to involve symbols. It's like involving a horse's skull because it's a symbol of, you know, a symbol of death.
Mm-hmm.
In Bill's case, well, in a lot of cases, bad guys are often ugly. If he's a bad guy, unless it's something like Glorious Godfrey from the Fourth World material, but most of the time, they're like the Wrecker. They're kind of beat up, and they're beefy, and they're scarred, and they're, you know, evil-looking kind of guy. They look evil.
Sure.
And you know, you don't have to say, oh, yeah, this guy over here, he's evil. Because you can, you know, you don't waste any words to do that. You can just say it. You just show it. We all know the deal. So in Bill's case, I made him look like a monster because I thought that people would think, oh, wow, this is a bad guy.
Sure.
Now, at the same time, what I'm overcoming is everybody that read Thor knew what the hammer's inscription actually said. I didn't get any letters at the time that said, oh, you know, Bill looks like kind of a monster, but really, because he's picked up the hammer, we all know he's a good guy. What I got was outraged letters about how can you let this evil guy pick up Thor's hammer? You don't know what the hell you're doing. I can't wait to buy next issue. And that's really what it came down to. I didn't get anybody that was saying, oh, yeah, I get it. I know what you're doing. You know, you're just, this is a graphic device to fool me. So in a couple of issues, when it turns out he's really a good guy, I'll be faked out. And by and large, at least people wrote to me, they pretty much were faked out. And that was kind of the idea. The idea is, you know, you want to worry the readers.
Sure.
And I thought, and that was the way that I did it. I gave him a variation of Thor's costume. I've seen some stuff about that too. Every so often, I'm very amused by these. You know, this is like Monday morning quarterbacking 20 years later, which is even funnier. But there was a clear reason for that, and the clear reason is, in giving him a variation of Thor's costume, I didn't really think that the hammer was like your automatic tailor. It didn't make suits for you exactly. But what it did is, when Bill slams that stick against the side of the ship and turns into this kind of Beta Ray Thor, when you see that costume, he doesn't have to say, wow, suddenly I've got a lot of power. I can create storms. I can throw lightning bolts around. I can do this. You know, the second you see that panel, exactly what's happened.
Sure.
And that's what the graphic storytelling in that medium is all about. It's for mainstream superheroes. That's how it works. So when I did that, it wasn't like anybody had to ask any questions about, well, what just happened to this guy? If I put him in some kind of a, you know, fancy outer space superhero suit, I'd have to spend some time explaining what just happened. Maybe no more than a couple of panels, maybe three or four panels. Maybe he'd wonder about it. But actually, by giving him the suit as I did, designing it the way I did, it was a combination of kind of science fiction super suit and Thor's outfit.
And today it would take like a full issue to explain that.
Well, I'm like old school. What can I tell you?
No, but you're right. The impact of that panel said it all.
So that's really where Beta Ray Bill as a visual came from. The name itself was inspired by the idea that I read a lot of science fiction back in the 60s and into the 70s. And really enjoyed it. I haven't read a lot in a long time now, but I really enjoyed it. And one of the things that that you have to do in science fiction is you've got guys going out to various planets, or you do in kind of the pulpier science fiction stuff, which I always really enjoyed. You know, you've got your little universal translator attached to your belt, and you meet some guy from the planet Gurk, and he speaks, and it comes out, hey, how you doing? Want to go for a pizza? You know, through your translator, just automatically happens to have all the information necessary to translate this language you've never heard before.
Sure.
Which, I mean, otherwise you spend a lot of your time, again, kind of getting around this. Unless you're writing a book about that, and some guys have, you don't want to spend the time explaining how the language gets translated.
Sure.
So my thought was that whatever Bill's real name is, it's not Beta Ray Bill. It's blah, 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 and that's how it comes out to the Universal Translator. Doesn't necessarily make any sense. In fact, but the one thing about it that does make sense is I kind of viewed Bill both as an extraordinary member of his own race because he survived this sort of contest in order to become the warrior he became.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, he was kind of every man for his race. He was the ideal of it, and yet the standard meter for the whole thing. The result was, originally I thought about giving him a name something like Beta Ray Jones, because I wanted one of the names to be a very common name.
Yeah, an everyman name.
Because an everyman name. Now, as it happened, so my first thought was Beta Ray Jones. I ditched the Jones partly because I was married to Louise Jones at the time, and she was editing under that name. She wrote under Simonson, but she edited under Jones. There was a Rick Jones already in the Marvel Universe.
Certainly.
At that time, I think, Marvel was doing Indiana Jones comics.
There you go.
And there might have at least been one or two other Joneses who read it. It just seemed that Jones was in high use at the time. So I abandoned that. I did Beta Ray because it sounds vaguely science fictional.
Absolutely.
And he's a science fiction kind of character. And in the Marvel Universe, Gamma Rays are already taken.
Yep.
So, and Alpha Rays, Alpha doesn't have, it's got that hard sound to start with. B. It just sounds cooler, even though Beta Rays are like loose electrons and they have no power whatsoever to speak of. But they're, you know, Beta Rays just sound kind of cool. And I went with Bill because of the alliteration.
Sure.
And because Bill, and of course William, it's kind of an everyman type name.
And he's back again. And
he is back again.
What do you think? I mean, I know that obviously it's a licensed character and you know, it's a work for hire situation. But have you had a chance to see any of the new incarnations of Bill?
You know, I've seen them. I was waiting for the trade paperback to come out to read the whole thing, because I know Mike Oeming is writing some of that stuff. I like Mike's work a lot.
Yeah.
But I haven't had a chance to read it yet, so I just got the paperback. I know it's been out for a while. I just got it a few weeks ago. and it's still sitting at my desk waiting to be read. So I have no comment about it. I have no thoughts about it. I haven't read any of it yet. So, but I mean, you know, the fact that you create a character and it kind of comes around on the guitar again in a shared universe is kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, that's good. And I'm glad to see that, you know, a creator like yourself has that attitude when someone new is taking one of your
ideas. Well, you know, when you do these characters in this situation, I mean, I will say that most of the books that I've done in the past, not, I mean, Battery Bill's a little different because it's a character rather than a book, but I mean, I really don't keep track of books that I have written and drawn after I leave them. I don't go back and see what's happened in the Fantastic Four for the most part. I would go back and read Thor. And I'm not quite sure why, except that maybe after I've done them for a while, I feel the voices of the characters so strongly. At that point, it's difficult for me to go back and read somebody else's version, except maybe, say, in the case of Thor or the FF, for example, the original Lee Kirby material.
Sure.
Or maybe even all the stuff that came before me. But once I've kind of done it, I have such a strong feeling about what the characters are like that I'm not so interested in where they go afterwards. And I hope they're successful. God bless them. But, you know, I'm just not going to sit there and keep track of them. I mostly don't.
No, I hear you. Stephen Grant made the same point about The Punisher. And with no, you know, malice or anything, just that, yeah, you hear your version of Thor's voice in your head.
And I've kind of, you know, I have been there. I have done that.
Sure.
So I keep track of other, you know, the comics I keep track of are other ones that I haven't done myself.
Well, let's talk about a few other been there's. One thing I liked, and it was interesting, and especially now with New Avengers and the way that it was kind of set up as an all-star cast, you had your new Fantastic Four.
I did, but it was sort of a mistake.
How so?
Or at least, I'll rephrase that. It wasn't planned as if, oh, this will be cool, we'll do a new FF. I mean, literally, the fact that it was going to be a new FF was the very last thing we thought of after we already had all the characters in place. Essentially, I took 3 issues off. Art Adams was going to draw them. I've known Arthur a long time.
Okay.
We wanted to work together. Arthur was going to draw them. And somewhere along the way, and I don't know where this idea came from, but, you know, I don't know where ideas come from generally. You know, they come from a lot of reading and watching movies and looking at magazines and talking on the phone and sitting around with you and your typewriter or now your computer and not much else.
Okay.
And you got to get ideas kind of formed somewhere in that matrix. So I had a thought about doing maybe guest starring. Might have been Spider-Man. I can't remember for sure. It was one of the hot characters at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And now I will say this with the knowledge that Kurt Busiek was a help. At the time, Kurt Busiek was working at Marvel for Carol Kalish.
Okay.
I think 1-4, whatever 4 that was at Marvel at the time, the 5th 4 or whatever, and in the direct sales department, I believe. And Kurt and I talked a little bit in the many years later, and he remembers a little differently than I remember it. So I'll give you my version. If you interview Kurt and ask him about it, he may give you a little different version.
Okay.
But, I mean, that's okay.
Sure.
You know, that's what history is all about.
Absolutely.
So, but the way I remember it is that, you know, I did go downstairs and talk to Carol every so often. I enjoyed talking to Carol. She was a sharp woman. She knew a lot about comics, about distribution, and about comics themselves. She was a big fan. And I really enjoyed getting her view on a lot of stuff because it gave me a different perspective on kind of what was happening in the business. Kurt was working there, and, you know, some of us were sitting around. Maybe, I don't remember if Carol was in the pack at the time in the group I was with, but she might have been because there weren't that many people there. But Kurt was out there and some other folks as well, 2 or 3 other guys. And we're talking about this, and I said, you know, I was thinking about doing the Fantastic Four and using, maybe it was Spider-Man, I can't remember. And my recollection of it is that Kurt said, well, look, if you're going to do Spider-Man, you've got to do the Punisher and Ghost Rider and Wolverine because they were all the hot characters at that moment.
Sure.
And we all cracked up, and it was like a joke, and we all laughed, and that was pretty funny. And then, you know, somewhere after I went home, or a little later that day, or somewhere, I was going, yeah, the Punisher. Yeah, Ghost Rider. Yeah, that's the ticket. Like John Lovitz, Saturday Night Live. Yeah, that's the ticket. Yeah, Wolverine. Yeah, Ghost Rider. And I know that, I thought that was a riot. So I know there might be a story in there. I called Arthur up and talked to Arthur, and Arthur's take on it was, well, look, I don't like the Punisher. I liked him when he was a villain. I don't like him so much as a good guy. I don't really want to draw him. And I said, hey, I don't care. Who do you want to draw instead? He said, well, how about the Hulk? I said, hey, no problem. So this is, I think, some variation from Kurt's version. But we have to ask him for his version.
Okay.
He's different. But anyway, so I asked Arthur what he wanted to do. I mean, often when I'm doing stories for other artists, I want to do stuff that they want to draw because I just think they'll really work to draw the stuff they like.
Sure.
So I said, what do you want to draw? All I can remember for sure now is that he wanted to draw the Hulk on a motorcycle. He wanted to draw a bunch of the old Marvel monsters from the 50s. He's a huge monster fan, Arthur is. So he wanted to draw a bunch of those old monsters, which I thought was cool. I think he wanted to draw the Mole Man. Those are the ones I can remember for sure. There may have been other things as well. And so basically I set about trying to put together a plot that I thought for over three issues would have all this stuff in it and would be fun. And somewhere in the middle of doing this, I thought, well, you know, gee, we've got the Hulk, who's, you know, kind of a, not an amalgam, I don't know the word I'm looking for here, but he's sort of an equivalent to the Thing.
Sure.
We've got Ghost Rider, who's got like his flaming head.
That's true.
Kind of like the Torch. You know, whether Wolverine or Spider-Man is Sue Storm, I don't know. It wasn't like a one-to-one correspondence. I wasn't trying to make it fit that way, but I just thought, well, you know, it's kind of this odd. You know, Spidey at least has kind of got the brains like Mr. Fantastic. So I guess that makes Wolverine Sue Storm, but I'm not going to go there. And we thought, well, I guess it's kind of like a new Fantastic Four. And so we used that as a hook for the story. But it was really, that was the last thing that I came to as a writer. It wasn't like I thought, wow, the new FF, won't this be cool? We really went the other way around. We put it all together and then said, oh, look, we've got four characters. And that's how that happened.
That's funny. That's great. And it's funny now because, you know, yeah, the new Avengers in its own way was kind of like all these popular characters being put together that they never thought to put together before.
Well, you know, it's true, although, you know, I mean, I think in some cases, I think in the past, you know, the Avengers, the original Avengers was kind of like that.
Yes, yes.
Their original lineup was kind of their main, you know, power superhero characters in the very beginning. So that's an idea that's been around a long time.
Let's
Justice League the same way.
That very true.
Probably the Justice Society. Although I don't know so much about the 40s comics, so I don't know if they were all. I would have guessed they were all kind of the main characters at the time, but I don't know that for sure. But the idea of putting a team together of your best guys is, you know, that's a tried and true idea.
Very true. And actually, I guess as we jump back a little bit, we're going to go back and forth time-wise. And I know a project you had before that new Fantastic Four was something you and Louise worked together on, X Factor. Bringing back the original X-Men. And I know that you guys took over the book after it initially started, around 10 or
so.
That's
right.
And one of the things you guys did was revamp the Angel.
We did. We took over with issue 5 or 6.
Okay.
I can't remember. I know Mark Sylvester drew at least a couple of issues that she did. I think Jackson Geist drew an issue or two. I don't remember who else was in that mix. I took over as the penciler with issue 10. And so I ended up being thrown right in the middle of the beginning of the Mutant Massacre, which was the first big crossover.
Mm-hmm.
And we were kind of off and running. But one of the ideas that I think we had, Weezy, I mean, it was really Weezy's idea. I kind of went along and you know, we would chat about it quite a bit, of course, at home. But the idea was, for us, is that by, you know, 89 or whatever, where were we doing that book, 88, 89, 90, in that period of time, mm-hmm. probably 89, 88, maybe a little earlier, 88 maybe, the characters, several of them seemed kind of out of date for where superheroes had gone in the, 25 years since the Marvel line had begun.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean, at the time, it seemed to us that Angel, you know, a guy whose power was to be able to fly for about an hour at about 60 miles an hour or whatever they were kind of, you know, vamping him at the time for, seemed a little underused or a little underpowered for that time and place.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, the Beast seemed kind of the same. You know, a guy could leap to a bar 15 feet over his head and hang on by his toes. Seemed like it was maybe a little low level for what was going on. Some of the characters, I mean, like Cyclops, in order to boost Cyclops, all you got to do is make his beams more powerful. There's no real reason to do a story that says, oh yeah, instead of blowing away, you know, the side of a building, he's blowing away the entire building.
Sure.
Or five buildings in a row. And Jean Grey was the same with her kind of, you know, powers, these telepathic powers,
mm-hmm.
or telekinetic, whatever they were. That was really easy to do more with. But we embarked really on a specific program for Iceman and the Beast and Angel to upgrade them, to kind of bring them up to what we thought would be more reasonable levels of power for kind of where Marvel superheroes were at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And we rather than just kind of wave a magic wand and say, okay, now they're all more powerful, we tried to tell stories about each of them that resulted at the end in their being more powerful. So Iceman got so powerful he had to have a belt for a while that, you know, kind of held him back to ordinary limits so he wouldn't just freeze everything. The Beast went back to being the Blue Beast, but with a good bit more strength and power.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Angel was probably the most radical change, where we replaced his wings and really gave him kind of more weaponry and kind of a grimmer look and did that with a whole storyline. But they were all storylines that we worked through the course of the issues that we were doing. And really the idea was to bring the whole team up to a kind of a tougher level.
And eventually I will get, would love to interview Wheezy down the line because, you know, her body of work is incredible. I'm wondering, in terms of working with your wife, what was that like?
Oh, it was fun. It was really, it was a pleasure.
Cool.
We've worked,
and not just because she might be standing next to you right
now.
Well,
she went upstairs, so I'm okay. I could probably say anything else, but it was really true. We actually worked together very well, and we worked in kind of all the capacities that we work in professionally, which is to say that initially, I think the first work I did for her was she was editing Battlestar Galactica. I did some writing on it.
Mm-hmm.
I was already drawing it, and then when the previous writer left the book, Roger McKenzie left the book, I took over as writer. That was my first writing gig in comics, my first major writing gig.
Okay.
And I wrote four of the last five issues. That was my real start as a writer, and she was the editor on that stuff. Then there was work like at the end of the 80s, early 90s, 90, 89, 90, somewhere in there, we did a book called Meltdown for Marvel, which was four 48-page comics that Jay Muth and Kent Williams painted that was a Havoc Wolverine crossover. And we co-wrote it. And that literally, one of us would be at the computer typing away, writing script, and you find a plot or whatever it would be, and you'd finally, you just got exhausted after a while. And you'd get up and you'd walk away, and the other person could just come in, sit down, and pick up right in the middle of a sentence and just be off and running. And it was really that easy. And there was a lot more to it than that, of course, but it was just that kind of collaboration. It came very easy for us. And then in the case of X-Factor, I was drawing stuff that she was writing. I wouldn't claim any credit as co-plotter. I think she did all the heavy lifting. But we talk about it, and we talk out some stuff, and the book came out pretty well when I finally made it into print, I thought.
Will we see any more collaborations between the two of you?
I would like to. I mean, it's not like we're not, you know, we're still speaking to each other, so as long as that happens, I think there's always a chance. She's not doing a lot of writing in comics at the moment. She's
okay.
Writing more children's books and young adult books at the moment. So it would be less of an opportunity for us to work together. But I would love to, again, at the drop of a hat.
Well, and I told you, I just picked up that Mangus robot fighter that she did. And was it last
year? Yeah, I did actually ask Byron, really, bless him, that about drawing it. And he said, oh, we couldn't really afford you. And that probably was true. But I would love to have drawn it. So I would have worked that in a heartbeat as well. So it was too bad. But, yeah, it did just come out. There's a second story and a second issue somewhere in the pipeline. But, you know, with Byron's death,
yeah,
I'm not really sure what the situation is with the second Magnus story. So
that's a shame.
I don't know whether that'll actually come out or not. But the one issue did finally make it out.
Yeah, and it looked great when you had they had Starenko's designs and stuff. So no, I was looking forward to a little bit more of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I hope they can do more. I don't know whether they will or not. I don't know anything about iBooks at the moment and what direction they're going to be going in. So we'll see.
Okay. You mentioned Battlestar Galactica. Have you had a chance to watch the new one?
No, I haven't yet. Although I've actually got some of them on tape to watch. A couple of my friends actually are big fans and have really enjoyed the revamp. And so I'm going, okay, I have to. Again, you know, I wrote and drew it for a while, but they're different characters. It's so different. I'm not really concerned about it. But I've actually heard good things about it. So.
It's great.
And I really like who's the guy playing Adama?
Edward James Olmos.
Edward James Olmos. I like him a lot.
Yeah, and certainly
I really like his work.
On the other side of Lord Green, I mean, certainly a 180 from Lord Green, but yeah, the concept is great. And the nice thing is they're interpreting the mythology in a different way, but the mythology is as important as in this new incarnation as it was in the original.
Oh, well, cool.
So
cool.
As we're talking about mythology, let's move on to the fourth world and all
okay.
Your work on that. You see, I'm in radio, so I can't help it. I'm born to transition.
Zoom. Nice segue.
Well, thank you. I know you backed up John Byrne when he was in charge of the Fourth World for a while. Am I correct? You did some backup stories?
Well, I did any backups for John. I did the covers for all the issues.
Okay.
I did all the covers but one of John's issues, both first when he was doing he was New Gods, then it became Jack Kirby's Fourth World.
Mm-hmm.
There was one cover I didn't do because I had some surgery, and so I was kind of out for the count for a few weeks, and John did the cover while I was not really able to do one. But other than that, this is a long time ago now, other than that, I did all the covers for his issues. I don't know that I drew a backup. I just remember doing the covers for his series.
Well, then,
and they were a lot of fun. I mean, I enjoy doing those immensely.
And then, of course,
then when he got off the book, he was going to get off and go to work to Marvel, I believe, at the time, is where he was headed. So I spoke to Paul Kupperberg, who was the editor of the book at the time, and asked about taking the book over after John was gone. Paul was cool with it. I was in the middle of some other projects. So it was about a year before I could actually get back to it. And by the time I got back to it, the book had moved over to Joey Cavallari. So Joey became the editor of the book. And we kind of started up fresh with a new number one and a new title, Orion, which is what I was. I felt that Jack Kirby's fourth one. John is brave enough to tackle that. I don't think I like that amount of courage. I just thought, you know, that was the whole fourth world stuff. Jack did those originally as four bi-monthly books, so two comics a month, four different titles, was the whole fourth world. That was more ambitious than I thought I was going to be able to handle. So I thought, let's cut that back to what I thought I could manage. And I liked Orion, maybe my favorite character in the fourth world material. He's probably because he's the most complex. And I thought he's not the most likable, which makes him maybe a harder sell as a hero, and certainly we didn't sell enough copies to keep on going. But I find him very interesting as a character, and so he was the guy I really wanted to do.
Is he the opposite of Thor in that spectrum?
I'd have to think about that. I mean, the thing is they share a lot of traits, and I don't know that Thor, even at the time I did it, I don't know that I had it. I mean, both of them really are warriors, and they're both warriors kind of by tradition and by birth. So that I think in that they share a great deal. I think Orion is clearly a much angrier character than Thor is.
Sure.
I mean, I think Thor isn't particularly angry. He's he was well-adjusted and grew up nicely, and that was about it. And Orion, as I've said before, it's very odd what Jack did. I mean, I thought it was great, but Orion's kind of the son of the devil. He's raised in heaven, and he's really screwed up. I mean, he's really this very angry kind of guy which gives him the power to be the greatest defender of the good guys that the good guys have. At the same time, Mr. Miracle, Scott Free, is kind of his opposite number in terms of the original hostage train. There's Scott, who's a son of heaven, raised in hell, and comes out of it being just this really sweet guy, just this really normal guy with a great-looking girlfriend.
You bet.
How does that work? It was kind of funny, really. In fact, it was that question that led me to my last issue of Orion, when I did a story about both Scott Free and Orion. I thought the idea that Scott could grow up in hell on Apocalypse and be so laid back. And, they keep coming after him, and they keep trying to drag him back into the West of the Godfather. They pull me back in, they keep trying to drag him back in. He always remains this really level-headed guy, It just doesn't seem to bother him much. He just fights and gets out with a grin, and, he's got that Errol Flynn swashbuckler. Just goes back to living at home with Big Barda. How does that work? What's that about? And so I did a story where I did a story about that.
The great thing about the Orion series, and I read enough of them where I really enjoyed and appreciated the tapestry. Now, you see, you didn't want to tackle the fourth world, but you really did put in, obviously through the catalyst of Orion, everything about Apocalypse, or a lot of things about Apocalypse. And one thing that I loved was Raker, the lost Green Lantern that was stuck on Apocalypse.
Oh, well, I didn't invent him. I forgot the name of the writer, and it's going to kill me for not getting it right. Please, when you put this up, find a guy's name and put it in there. Is it Bob? It was a long story. It was maybe a 60-page Green Lantern story from a couple of years earlier.
No kidding.
It had several artists on it. Graham Nolan did some of it, and other artists did some work on it as well. It was one long story about it. And I gave a little summary of it in Orion so that people who hadn't seen the original version would have some idea of who the character was and where it came from.
But
I didn't invent his background. That was all this earlier material. And I just thought it'd be kind of cool to go back and address that and use the character and tip my hat to what was kind of an interesting idea.
My exposure to Raker was through your issue, and I just thought it was great because you have that typical scene on Apocalypse of, the sea of lost souls, and somewhere in there is this guy who doesn't have his power ring anymore and is still able to survive on his wits. And it came through.
Yeah, it was fun. I really enjoyed doing the character. I've done a few Green Lantern illustrations, drawings that came up as covers and stuff like that, but I haven't done any Green Lantern stories. It was just kind of fun to be able to do one, even kind of an over an Apocalypse Green Lantern
story. Yeah, too bad that Orion didn't last longer, because it was a very interesting series. And I think, much like Thor, you built on what, Kirby had established and put on this foundation, and you went into interesting directions.
Well, his work is so rich in a lot of ways that it really lends itself to all kinds of treatments. And of course, the fourth world material itself, even in Jack's time, really got kind of stopped short for whatever reason.
Yes.
So there's plenty of room to kind of pick up and run with the ball at that point. And I those are some of my favorite comics, and I just had a great time doing that book.
You had national exposure on something so silly and so trivial, and you know where I'm going now.
Exactly where you're going, and you're right. It was incredibly silly, and I thought it was a riot.
So yeah, one little throwaway move of cutting Wonder Woman's hair, and CNN demands to know why.
I love reading fan stuff on the web where they talk about cynical, oh, the manipulation of the market. They're just doing this to sell comics. They're just trying to foist a few copies. I'm thinking, my job is to sell comics. That's what I'm trying to do, Honestly, if anybody had said to me in advance, look, you cut Wonder Woman's hair, we're going to sell that comic out, and you'll be interviewed by the AP and by the New York Daily News, and I would have gone, oh, please, get a grip. And yet that's exactly what happened, and there's a result, especially in the AP story. We were all over papers all over the world. At one point, I think the Comics Journal website, somebody pointed this out to me. I went there and took a look. They had a thing up where all these local television stations around the country. They have like their kind of light news entertainment section on the web. And a lot of it picked up this story that I'd been interviewed for. And, everybody just ran it pretty much verbatim from the original AP, which did not get all the details right, but that was okay. It was just like, what did you expect? But it was everywhere. It was really funny. John Byrne's dad called him and said, it came out, John told me this, and said, the local paper here in Calgary, Canada, has this article on Wonder Woman. And that was a long way from anywhere. So I got a note somewhere. There was an article in the paper in Australia, maybe in Sydney, Australia. So, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, I wish I could manipulate the market so successfully every damn time I do a comic book.
You're not but that calculating.
It was really a bit that grew out of the story I was telling, that's what I try to do. I try to develop a story and then follow bits and pieces of it logically to try and make it all, make some sense in the context of the story itself. And in that case, where I was doing a thing where she was kind of a fugitive and she knew that somebody, some unnamed person or persons or entity or whatever, one entity as it turned out, was trying to kill her, which they were not trying to do, but she didn't know that at the time. She was out there trying to kill her, and she didn't know who she was. She had amnesia. She was just, it's like The Fugitive with Harrison Ford. He started off in the movie with a beard, and the first thing he does when he's a fugitive, he shaves his beard off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good thinking. Not that I've ever been a fugitive, but I'm thinking, yeah, okay, this seems to make sense. How about if I just don't look like myself? I didn't give her an eye patch. That might have caused less furor, but cutting her hair, getting her hair cut. And, of course, the thing about hair is, even in comic books, it does grow back. So that was a riot. I saw stuff about that on the web. We got interviewed, by media. It was really silly. And I think the first two issues that I wrote sold out. The second one was when I actually featured the haircut. It sold out when it came out, and the other one sold out retroactively.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was. It was very funny. Well, it was the kind of thing where we got PR that we couldn't possibly have, you couldn't have paid for.
Sure.
Because the way it worked out, the article in the Daily News, which I think the paper actually broke that, if you want to call it breaking a story, we'll say that for the purpose of simplicity. But it actually came out a day or two either side of the comic coming out with that haircut.
Okay.
So that you could read the story in the paper and go, what the heck are they doing? And you have to go buy the comic.
Sure.
And then the AP did a story. I was actually out of town when this was happening. I was out doing a convention in Cleveland.
Okay.
And so I was interviewed on the phone for these. I got interviewed with the Daily News on the phone one night, and the AP called the next morning and caught me in my hotel room before I went over to the convention. We did a short interview then, and then that was up on the wire, I think, by the afternoon.
Insane.
And the comic came out right at that moment, so we couldn't have paid people to have timed it better.
That's so funny.
It was very funny. Doing the book was fun, but that was really, those are those things you just can't predict that kind of stuff.
It seems like most of your output is cover work.
Well, it is, but I've been working the same project for better than 2 years now.
What are you working on?
Don't tell DC I said that. I'm just surprised DC hasn't fired me yet. They've been very kind, actually. But I'm actually working on a long Elric story of Michael Moorcock.
Okay, great.
I'm an old Elric fan. I read the first two Elric books one short story, one novel, back when I was in college myself in the mid-60s, the first one that came out in this country.
Yes, yes.
And I've known Michael for a number of years now. So we're working on an Elric story. Two issues are actually out. It's going to be four 48-page comics when it's done. And it's really a kind of Elric the early years.
Okay.
Because it's Elric before he gets the Black Sword. It's before he cuts his first deal with his patron saint, if you want to call it, or demon, Arioch, one of the Lords of Chaos. His father is still the emperor, but all the scheming, subterfuge-y kind of things are already going on. His conflict with his cousin, Akun, is already happening.
Mm-hmm.
Samoro is, you know, his cousin is also, his romantic interest is there. And so this is actually most of the, I don't know if all the Elric stories have been published in comics, maybe not, I'm not sure, but most of them have been adaptations of prose material. And this is a story that Mike has written for the comic.
Wow.
So it's not like it's been out before. And really, now the third issue is done. DC's hanging on to it. I'm working on the fourth issue right now. My guess is, although this is just a guess, DC has not said this, they'll probably hold the third issue until the fourth issue is about wrapped up. And then they'll publish the two of them together when they come out, or, you know, in sequence, rather than one now, one 6 months from now, or whenever it would come out.
Okay.
So that'll, I've just been taking me a long time to do the work, much longer than I ever anticipated, longer than DC ever anticipated, I must say. But for a variety of reasons, which are too boring to explain here,
okay.
It wouldn't make any sense anyway. The only one that does make sense, is it slowed me up a lot, is that I'm working twice up in the artwork, because Mike's work is so visual that I want all the room I can get to draw everything.
Is this a thrill? This has to be a thrill.
It's great. I mean, it's a riot. I mean, the good thing about this, probably, I was grousing about it earlier. Now, after all this time, I'm not grousing about it anymore. I could easily have drawn each one of these stories as a 96-page comic.
Okay.
Thank God that didn't happen.
Jeez.
Only because I'd love to have used larger panels, bigger pictures,
sure,
more stuff. But what it really is, what's going on in the books, without giving up too much, I don't think, even the ones that haven't come out yet, is that, in a way, these are Elric's first encounters with the Black Sword.
Okay.
And with Arioch. And with a lot of the stuff that is the basis for his ongoing story. And I couldn't be more pleased that I'm getting to draw it. It's probably one of the reasons I'm so slow, too, is I really want to get it right. And I think that's probably a mistake. I should just be brave and go ahead and do it. But it's really, and Mike gives you a lot of latitude in the pictures. There's a lot of stuff in there that may not be strictly according to Hoyle compared to some of the writing he's done in some of the earlier versions. But you know, the multiverse that Michael Moorcock created is nothing if not fluid.
Very cool.
And so I've taken that to heart, and I'm really kind of, with Michael's guidance on a lot of the visuals, because he has visual suggestions, but then I'm really free to kind of take off in whatever direction I want. I'm really trying to create a kind of a complete world inside the comic. And it's been really a treat, but it has been a long project.
Well, we look forward to its completion.
Well, thank you. Me too. I'm sure DC and Mike do as well.
I know you're exclusive right now to DC, or I'm guessing you are.
Yep.
Should you ever free up, would something like Conan or something like that ever appeal to you?
I don't know. I've done exactly three drawings of Conan in my career.
Okay.
All solo drawings. One was a cover for Conan. Mm-hmm. One was a cover for King Conan when it was running briefly.
Mm-hmm.
My wife edited both those books for a while. And one was an actual drawing of Conan, just a portrait of him, a la John Buscema, really, in something I did with Roy Thomas a million years ago called The Hyborian Age. It was an adaptation of an essay that Robert E. Howard wrote. That was his faux history of the world that led up to the beginning of known history.
I see.
So it was his tale, his story of Atlantis and the world of Kull, the world of Conan, how all those things fit together and eventually came together to become Sumer and Ur and Babylon and so on. It was just his interest in history, his fake history against which his stories were set. Roy Thomas wrote the adaptation, and I drew it for the Savage Show of Conan Black and White back in 1974. It was fun. But it was a picture of Kull in the drawings. There was a picture of Conan. But they were just portraits of the characters. They weren't. It wasn't a story.
It wasn't sequential.
I don't know. You know. I mean, I like Conan. I don't have any real desire to draw Conan.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean that if I didn't get a call tomorrow, I said, Walt, here's $1 million. How about drawing Conan? Okay. Well, you know, hey.
Love him.
You know, basically, I'm just a gun for hire, and you know, if the pay is good enough, I'm hireable.
Also, I want to mention, I love the Day of Vengeance covers. I think they were
great. Thanks.
And they really look good. And it was so great seeing a lot of these third-tier characters come back. And Bill did a great job with the stories. But, you know, just great seeing your distinct look.
You know, I'll be Bill's fan forever, if only for Detective Chimp.
Yes, yes. No kidding. Absolutely.
He had a great Detective Chimp.
You
really
bet.
Funny. So they were fun. They were fun to do. That was for Joey Cavallari, and he asked me to do them, and I had a real good time doing them. So, and I actually did them with Justiniano last night. So
very
it was
cool.
Him and Joey. So we chatted about a lot. We didn't talk about the Vengeance stuff so much, but we covered a lot of stuff and had a good time. So
that's cool.
It was fun to draw.
You got anything coming up with Crisis? Are you going to be doing any covers or anything?
I don't think so. I'm not really doing anything. I mean, the Elric stuff, I've got a couple more months of work to do, and really I'm at a point where until that stuff is done, I never think about it again, at least about this particular project. I want to get that done, then I'll think about other stuff.
Okay.
So for the moment, that's really, you know, once that's done, that's really what I'm going to be doing.
Okay, and you're teaching.
I am. I teach the School of Visual Arts in New York City.
That's great, and then what a tradition that school has, so it must be wonderful.
They've got a lot of tradition. You know, Eisner taught there, and Harvey Kurtzman, and Carmen Infantino, David Mazzucchelli teaches there now. Klaus Janssen has been teaching there for a long time. Sal Amendola, and the mainstream guys, the guys that I know. But I know Gary Pantcher teaches there as well. I'm leaving a couple of guys out. I can see their faces. My brain's gone away. So, but it said, yeah, they've got some cool guys teaching there, actually, and kind of in a broad range. It's not just mainstream or just alternative, but they really kind of cover the waterfront. And then and a guy like David Mazzucchelli, you probably have everything kind of covered at once.
Sure, that's cool. And yeah, how are the young crop that's going to be hitting the atmosphere pretty soon? How are they doing?
I've got some good students this year. I've got some good guys doing some work right now that's pretty impressive. Mostly the work I've got that's the most impressive is probably more in the alternative end of things rather than the mainstream end of things. But there's some mainstream stuff happening as well, so I'm not sure these guys will have jobs the minute they get out of school, but they're heading in the right direction, and hopefully they'll be a little closer by the time the school year is over.
That's cool. They'll learn a lot if they're paying attention to you, man.
I hope so.
So, listen, I appreciate your time tonight.
Thank you for joining us.
All
right, cool. My pleasure.
That'll wrap things up for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. Be sure to check in at wordballoon.com for more information about upcoming interviews. This is John Suntress. Word Balloon is a copyrighted feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2005.